Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, my guest tells the story of Bobby Bluejacket, a Tulsa street hustler, criminal, prisoner, and prison journalist, later used car salesman, prisoner again, and later a reformed man, and now a Shawnee tribal elder. Bluejacket came to notoriety in 1948 in Tulsa for his role in a street rumble that resulted in the death of an oil man's son. Bluejacket was convicted of first-degree manslaughter just 2 weeks after the death and sentenced to 99 years. He was later paroled and eventually pardoned 12 years later, having seemingly rebuilt his life. More troubles with the law would come later. Bluejacket knew virtually every major figure in the Tulsa underworld for close to 40 years. In telling his remarkable life story, writer and journalist Michael P. Daly says Bluejacket's experiences gives history a fuller picture of life in Oklahoma and Tulsa at that time than any biography of a notable or famous person ever could. In his book, Bobby Bluejacket, The Tribe, The Joint, The Tulsa Underworld, Daly tells his subject's story, but also describes the cultural history of every institution he encountered. Tulsa in the 1930s and 40s, the socioeconomic and racial divides, Indian schools, the Oklahoma correctional system, and the very different relationship that existed between law enforcement, politicians, and criminals in a day of a dry Oklahoma. We're replaying our interview from February today because Daly has returned to Tulsa for two book signings this weekend, and because of your reaction when we first aired this. We'll hear from Bluejacket a little later in the program. Here's author Michael Daly. Michael Daly, well, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
First of all, congratulations on this book, because it's really an amazing cultural history as much as it is a story of Bobby Bluejacket. How did you first learn about him?
Well, first off, thank you. And yeah, I'd set off to, on one hand, make a biography, but also show kind of the social and cultural forces that both informed Mr. Bluejacket's life and how Mr. Bluejacket kind of informed those forces to an extent. But yeah, the first time I guess the way I found Mr. Bluejacket is kind of a long, circuitous story in its own right, which goes back about 7 years. I was working in the rare book game in New York City at that time, and we basically would take rare books, cultural archives, sell them to museums. And through that process, I got acquainted with Larry Clark, who I'm sure you know is a famous Tulsa-born photographer and filmmaker. And through working with Larry, it was decided we'd maybe try to do some sort of history around his seminal photo book called Tulsa from 1971. And the book, for those listening that don't know, it's a pretty intense documentation of 60s drug culture in Tulsa, primarily among a group of teenagers who were Larry's friends. So I'd begun this process of researching kind of Tulsa crime, Tulsa in general. I'm from Chicago, and again, I've been living in New York at the time, so I'm not a native Oklahoman. And through this process, I had gotten access to listen to some tapes Larry had made during the process of shooting this film around 1968-69. Now, on these tapes, it's a couple, petty thieves going back and forth, and one's talking about how he couldn't get bond, and another guy in the tape says, well, why don't you talk to Bluejacket? And I thought, wow, that's a pretty cool name, and started to look into, who this Bluejacket guy is. And Larry had told me, oh, he's this legendary figure who had killed a guy in a teen rumble in 1948. And so kind of my initial research into Bluejacket without having actually met him or knowing much was that he was kind of this, American trope of what you think about of the outsider as a rebel without a cause, but, is real life and had occurred about 10 years before this became any sort of cultural archetype. So anyways, I kind of hit a roadblock of being able to find out anything about him for a while, and then came across Ron Padgett, another great Tulsan, his memoir of his father, Oklahoma Tough. Now, Ron's father is Wayne Padgett, who was a prominent bootlegger back in the day in Tulsa, and he also happened to be friends with Bobby Bluejacket. So I reached out to Ron, and he connected me with Bluejacket, and I called Bluejacket one day about over 5 years ago, and interviewed him about a couple characters in Larry Clark's book. After the interview, we kind of just talking about his life, and it became pretty clear right off the bat that this guy had one of the wildest and kind of most interesting lives of anyone I've ever spoken to. So over the next couple months, we became friends, started talking, going back and forth, and it kind of naturally came to be that this project with Larry Clark drifted off into, kind of a nether zone, and I became more and more interested in Bluejacket at the same time and decided to write the story of his life.
And so what was it so appealing about his story?
Well, he's a guy that, first off, I mean, before touching upon any specific component of an experience, he's just, as a persona, incredibly charismatic. He's hilarious. And at the same time, as a person, he exudes more emotion than pretty much anyone you'd meet on the street. He's just a very powerful personality. And, you know, as I found out more about him, I realized this is a guy whose life has intersected all these kind of various untold histories of the United States, whether that be prison history, the histories of the underworld, his experiences in Eastern Shawnee Man, attending boarding schools as part of the Native Assimilation Campaign, his later work in, I'd call it being a political impresario in the 60s in Tulsa.
That's right.
You know, it's kind of, I saw him as one single person's experience that kind of reflected all these disparate elements of, you know, what it means to live in the United States.
And he really is a larger-than-life persona in many ways. And really, at his age now, you don't hear a lot about him. But for Tulsans of a certain age, he was either notorious, he was kind of a fixer at some point. He was certainly a part of the Tulsa underworld. He knew most of the major figures in, say, the Dixie Mafia in the 1960s and 70s. And he's just sort of a witness to an era in Tulsa history.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, it's rare to find someone that is kind of a Geisy-type figure like that. And I think what makes it more interesting is not only his proximity to all these people and these events, but his own interpretation of what they mean and what they stood for. And I try to really make the book a lot about not just what happened, but what Blue Jacket thought of what happened historically.
And what it seems to be in his story, he's pretty brutally honest about his life and things that he did which lay outside the norms of normal behavior. You know, by his own accounts, he took pride in being called a thief, you know, and the honor in that particular term. Was it important to corroborate his story, and how difficult was it to corroborate the story?
So, yeah, I tried it as rigorously as possible to corroborate a lot of these tales. You know, I say in the preface of the book that, you know, a lot of the some various kind of tales of the underworld, no one was there taking notes. There were no photographs. You're basically left with whoever the survivor's, you know, telling is. So there is a level of ambiguity when it comes to histories like this. But, you know, I did try to go through a painstaking attempt of attempting to corroborate these various tales with what was in the newspapers and, you know, show that there were kind of multiple angles to some of these things.
One of the things that's really interesting is the sidebars you tell. Is you mentioned in the very beginning of the book, you said, you know, what you're telling Bobby Blue Jacket's story is a micro history. And in fact, you write that in some ways it's a better way to tell a story of a time than a story of the rich and powerful. So what is your impression about the time and place that he describes?
Yeah, that was definitely kind of the angle that I came upon this with. And that was a style of history that was kind of pioneered by mostly Italian and some French historians back in the middle kind of 60s and 70s. And yeah, the idea there is essentially that while the kind of great man theory of history, your presidents, your kings, your war heroes might be more extraordinary in a lot of circumstances, they don't necessarily summarize or encapsulate what it was like for kind of most people in a historical time and place. And so I saw Blue Jacket in this way as a guy who's an extraordinary figure in his own right, but was maybe a little closer to some of the experiences a lot of people were having at the time, whether those were poverty, racism, desire to succeed, kind of how they fit in against the backdrop of local politics. And the other kind of component of interest, I think, with the micro-historical focus is that a lot of the way we talk about politics and society today, at least in kind of your media discourse, is that it's very abstracted and kind of universal. And I think what interests me is kind of the hyper-specificity of Blue Jacket's story. It's very local. He's a guy that's not well-known. And so it really allowed me to kind of hone in on the specific circumstances of his life and his specific point of view on those circumstances.
One of the first things I felt engaged about in the book was the cultural history of Tulsa in the 1930s and 40s. And Michael Mann writes about this in his book about Dillinger and the infamous criminals of the 1930s in his book about Chicago crime. You know, this relationship between law enforcement and offenders during that time. It was not, cops and robbers, I mean, they interacted with one another. They knew each other. They would interact socially at times, and then other times it was like, I'm here to bust you. And it was the same way in Tulsa during the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, you know, one thing I found, and this is, you know, obviously I wasn't there, but through Blue Jackets telling and research I've done, is that these are all guys that are coming out of the Depression in a way that there is a universal suffering, whether you wore a badge or you had a, you know, a mask on, robbing a joint, where I think there was a bit more of a mutual understanding of kind of everyone's compromised economic state, and that you did what you had to do to survive in a way. It just created this almost like neighborly relationship to where, yeah, you might have to arrest a guy occasionally, but you also, you know, would shake his hand if you saw him in a restaurant. And that's something that's quite different from kind of the relationship of law enforcement to lawbreakers today.
And of course, you also write after Bobby was out after his conviction for manslaughter, you know, he's rubbing shoulders with, you know, a future governor, David Hall. He's rubbing shoulders with highly placed political figures in the state. And it just seems like that is an era that would no longer, you know, a politician today, you know, would have a longer than a 10-foot pole from anybody like a Bobby Blue Jacket. But it was not that case in the 1950s and 60s. Some of that is testament to Blue Jacket himself. He is a very charismatic person, as you mentioned. But was that surprising to you?
It was. And that kind of gets back to that, like, very sense of the hyper-specific and the hyper-local, where, one, I think even the most well-groomed Ivy League guy should be worried about competition from Blue Jack in the political field, because he's just extremely charismatic, again, excellent writer and speech maker, to where there is a level of kind of superiority in his political acumen, even if he is coming out of prison. But there is that thing where it was just, I think if you were willing to maybe get involved at the time, and he kind of had the confidence to walk up and shake these guys' hands, that that kind of put him in a place of somewhat political prestige. And I think the second half of that is through his process of appealing his original sentence and eventually getting paroled, he had come into contact with all these various prominent figures, both in Tulsa journalism, famous guys like Nolan Bullock, and then people on the pardon and parole board like Charlie Chestnut, Tex Bynum, and through them, other political figures like Jay Jones, who had been with Tulsa PD, in kind of various politicos at the time.
It's sort of a tribute to him that, you know, Nolan Bullock, who was a muckraking Tulsa Tribune reporter and crime journalist of the time, who probably contributed to Bobby's sentence for manslaughter for his sensational articles about it, later becomes one of his biggest defenders.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think Blue Jacket says in the book that, you know, Nolan convicted me. And that was a kind of a big thing in this case, where no one in the jury box hadn't read any of the news on this story. It had been in kind of front page news for the 2 weeks leading up to the trial. So it was very informed by journalism. And, you know, Nolan was right there up in front as kind of someone painting a negative picture of Blue Jacket. But yeah, it came to be that later on, he was one of his biggest boosters, essentially. And throughout his life until he died, which was in, I think, 71 or the early 70s,
my guest today is Michael Daly. He's a writer and journalist. He specializes in crime and cultural history. His latest book is titled Bobby Blue Jacket, The Tribe, The Joint, and the Tulsa Underworld. It's published by First Enoch Books, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We haven't really talked about the case that brought Bobby Blue Jacket to widespread notoriety, at least in this area of Oklahoma. And that was the May 1948 incident. This probably had to contribute to you deciding to write this book, because it was an incident where he killed a man in a scene that reads just like something out of S.E. Hinton's book, The Outsiders. Same socioeconomic divides. It wasn't socias and greasers, but it was basically a fight gone bad. What was your reaction to learning about this incident?
My first impressions were from what I had heard from Larry Clark, which was basically a retelling of what was the legend of Bobby Blue Jacket, which I later found out to be completely false. And then also a denial of appeal record, which basically is some Oklahoma Court of Appeals judges in rather sensational fashion describing their interpretation of what occurred in this incident. You know, as I interviewed Blue Jacket and then went through the rather large court transcripts themselves, it became much more ambiguous, to the point that, you know, I personally believe he was wrongly convicted, almost certainly wrongly sentenced, as he was given 99 years for what ultimately was an accidental death. So this was kind of my first introduction to Blue Jacket, and probably the single most life-changing event in his life. So yeah, it's a very important part of the story. It's not all the story, of course, but it was central and probably a thing that kind of kicked off my research.
You wrote very poignantly about his incarceration during that time and also how he matured. And by his own account, you know, he likened himself to the Joe Pesci character in Goodfellas, somebody who was always popping off, always a dangerous character in many ways, and how he matured. He was really lucky to be incarcerated in that particular time because he got educated. He took classes at Southwestern State College at that time, played football and baseball for prison teams, and really benefited from this period of truly a time where the correctional system was really trying to correct if inmates were willing to go that route.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I don't know if you're ever quite lucky in the literal sense to be incarcerated, but if you had to be incarcerated in Oklahoma, you could do much worse than Oklahoma State Reformatory in the 1950s under the warden Joe Harp. And it was a deal that had he gone to prison 10 years before or 10 years after, it would have been completely different. But he arrived at this time where Oklahoma State Reformatory had been basically turned into a penal backwater and was just completely broken down. And the state of Oklahoma instilled this guy, Joe Harp, become warden, and he completely overhauled the whole system. And as you said, they introduced a prison newspaper, which became central to Blue Jacket's sense of identity and skill set, sports teams, and probably most importantly, desegregated education system. This was kind of central to Blue Jacket's maturation and gave him kind of the tools that he'd used through the rest of his life, particularly when he did work for the Eastern Shawnee tribe much later as a activist and speech maker and eulogist.
Were you surprised to read his writings? I really was. I thought they were, you know, he's a fine writer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's one of my favorite writers I've ever read. Because, again, as you said, there's a real honesty to the way he tells things to where, I mean, even his really early writings when he's first going to school and stuff in the penitentiary and at the reformatory, there's kind of a brutal honesty and beauty that you, I don't know, couldn't get from a career novelist in Park Slope. I mean, it's truly powerful stuff in a way that's, I think, hard for anyone to capture.
One of the things Tulsans will enjoy reading are these sidebars that you take along the way. You said, you know, in telling Bobby's story, you also wanted to tell a larger cultural history. And I mentioned your descriptions of Tulsa in the 30s and 40s, using things like photos from the Beryl Ford collection to give us a sense of what Tulsa was like during that time. Depictions in the history of Indian schools in the state. You take us on that sidebar. And, of course, the correctional system, which and its focus at that time on rehabilitation. I was completely surprised to hear how the correctional system worked in those years, where it was not uncommon in McAllister to see inmates walking down the street of McAllister in the 30s on their way to labor somewhere in the town. The fact that the prison baseball team and football team were traveling all over the state and going into communities, going up to Southwestern State to take classes. Considering where our correction system is today, was astounding.
Yeah, it was pretty wild, and I think I still am kind of blown away sometimes when I think about that. And I think some of the questions that time raises we're still dealing with, which is things like, should you really be monetizing prison labor, for example, things like that, where, you know, racial disparities in the population. So as much as it's history, it's still very much a present issue in a different form.
Michael Daly is the author of Bobby Blue Jacket, The Tribe, The Joint, and The Tulsa Underworld. It's published by First to Knock Books. I spoke with him back in February. Daly returns to Tulsa for two book signings this weekend, Saturday at 2 o'clock at Magic City Books in the Tulsa Arts District, and Sunday at 2 at Bound for Glory Books on East 11th, just west of Yale. He'll be joined by the book's subject, Bobby Blue Jacket himself, who I also spoke with back in February. Bobby, thanks very much for joining us here on Studio Tulsa.
Well, you're welcome, Rich, and thank you, sir, for inviting me to be a part of your show.
Now, we heard Michael Daly's reason for writing about you and his interest in you. What was your reaction to his interest in you?
Well, my reaction was through my friend Ron Paget, whom you know well.
Yes.
I've known Ron all of his life by virtue of my friendship with his dad, Wayne Paget. And I had given Ron quite a bit of material for use in his book concerning his dad. And so he called me one day and asked me if I would be welcome to for him to introduce me to Michael, that Michael had an interest since he had been told a few things about me. And I acquiesced to that request.
Well, what was it like to revisit your life like this as a subject of a biography? Incidents of some of which I'm sure were not easy to relive, or you might even have regrets about. What was that process like?
I had no idea the length and the in-depth writing that he would do. But I told him at the time, I said, Michael, it's all the truth. The thing that I enjoyed about the book more than anything was the truth, however brazen and however vulgar and however hardened it appears to be. My life isn't that today, and I wanted to be able to assert that.
Daly not only quotes your oral interviews with him, but he also quotes your writing at length. And I was really struck by your honesty and eloquence in your writer. You're really a fine writer. Are you kind of sad that writing wasn't a larger part of your life?
Absolutely. When I was a young guy out here at Will Rogers High School, 14 years old, 10th grade, I didn't even know how to make a book report. I couldn't make a book report. I'd sit and stare at the piece of paper. But when I went to prison in 48, I was very fortunate that I knew at least half or more of the people there. And I had a relative there, Charlie Brewer, Charlie Squirrel. Very, very intelligent person, just a marvelous mind. And those people welcomed me into their circle. That was the start of the rebuilding of my life, however many years it took. And it was many, many, many years after my going to prison in 1948 that I eventually got straightened out. But that was the beginning of it, with those 10 people that I surrounded myself in prison, most of them Second War veterans, one or two of them old-timers that had been there for years, and then a mobster out of Kansas City that I'd met in the Tulsa County Jail, Jew Eddie Snyder, years ago. And he welcomed me there to prison and gave me a real helping hand as well.
But you just, what I admired about it was you really matured in prison and tried to better yourself, got yourself an education. We were talking earlier, Michael Daly said it's never a lucky time to be incarcerated, but if you have to be incarcerated, you were perhaps at a time when the correctional system was really trying to correct or rehabilitate prisoners. And you had the ability to go to college at Weatherford as a prisoner.
Oh, yes, sir.
Really an amazing short time in our correctional system in the state in which you were able to better yourself.
Well, it was a real transition period, Rich, and they were coming out of the dark ages. The rule had always been before, when you stepped through that prison gate, was to put on that mental muzzle, fall in line, keep your mouth shut, and do your time. But there was a period there when the riots were just beginning, and Oklahoma sensed the situation that they could avoid. And so that's when they appointed Joe Harp and Raymond Rand over at Granite to transition and remake that reformatory into the model that they wanted it to be concerning education. And that's where my education started there.
You know, as not knowing your story, as I was reading the book, I was really, really rooting for you when you were paroled in, I think it was 1957 or 1958.
Right.
And I was really rooting that you were able to make your own way. You had a successful business for a while, but it was tough, wasn't it?
Well, it was tough, and it was all my own doing that caused me to relapse. And I can explain it this way. Most of us guys and kids out of the streets, we knew how to make money. I could make money anywhere, but I was never taught how to keep money, what to do with it once I got it. And that was the thing that where my life spiraled apart, and I got back into that criminal element. back in the 60s after I got out of prison and got my, you know, I got a pardon on that murder charge. J. Howard Edmondson signed the pardon papers for me. But no, my getting back into the criminal element and doing the things I did there in the 60s was all my choosing, and it was a relapse of mine, and I regret it. I regret it because I had a little boy and a little girl, and they suffered more than I suffered by virtue of not having a daddy. Later, when I made a lot of money and I was able to send them to Canada and go to Canada with them and ski all over the north part of the country, I was always wanting to do something to make that up. But let me tell you, Rich, you can't make it up, son. Once it's gone, with your children, can't make it up.
You know, you did understand the consequences of your life. Daly also spends time on how important your Shawnee heritage is today.
Oh, yeah.
Was it always important to you, or was it something that's coming to you with maturity?
It come to me as I got old. And it come to me after I got out of prison the last time, which was 25 years ago. And I started going back up around my tribe. And I knew that there would be people that questioned anything I said, any motive that I might get involved with. So I had a plan. I walked in there and I disarmed them immediately because I had still had some people that knew me by virtue of my family. So I immediately told everybody that, yeah, I am an ex-convict and I spent X number of years in prison, but I'm here as a member of the tribe now and going to do the best I can. And that's how I started. And they embraced me. They welcomed me in. And everything I know about being Indian, I've learned since the age of about 63 years old. I knew about being Indian when I was a little boy at the Indian school, other than what Grandma used to tell us and things about the laying on our back and looking into the sky and seeing the stars. And Grandma told us the stars are the old Indians up there looking over us. Those was play stories that she gave us when we was children, tiny children. But the rituals, the ceremonies, the traditions, I didn't know any of that. I had a person that we were talking about being a tribal elder. I'm a designated tribal elder. And I said, well, I'm an elder because I'm old. He said, oh, no, Bobby. He said, you're an elder because you're wise. And I said, let me say this. Any wisdom that I've acquired, I acquired by putting my feet in the footsteps of those that walk the good grass. And I sit at their knee. I sit beside them as an old man and listen to them. I went in the sweat lodge that I helped build, and I sat and listened to their prayers. And that's how I learned being Indian again, the remaking of an Indian boy into an Indian elder.
Bobby Bluejacket speaking with us back in February here on Studio Tulsa. His remarkable life is the subject of Michael Daly's biography, Bobby Bluejacket, The Tribe, The Joint, The Tulsa Underworld, published by First Enoch Books. We're repeating this interview today because, one, it got a tremendous response when it first aired, and they have two signings this weekend, Saturday at 2 o'clock at Magic City Books in the Tulsa Arts District, and Sunday at 2 at Bound for Glory Books on East 11th, just west of Yale. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.